Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Dr. Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. If you've never listened to our show before, and why would you have? We're a relatively informal medical slash science podcast, and we look at the intersections of public health and pop culture and the news and whatever else I want to talk about. Before we get to our topic today and our lovely guest, and we have an amazing show for you today. I want to first thank and introduce our new sponsors. This episode of the House of Pod is brought to you by artificial intelligence and medicine. We can't get it right for driving, but sure, medicine is simpler. Let's do that. Oh, friends, we live in interesting times. Universities around this fine country of ours is filled with students protesting. Schools like Columbia, Harvard, MIT, Berkeley, USC, and more are seeing protests in support of the Palestinian people or against genocide, depending on how you want to frame it. And several of these schools have called in police to remove demonstrators or at least invite them onto campus. At UCLA, opposing protest groups have physically clashed on campus after crossing a barrier meant to keep them apart. There's been police in USC, at Washington University in St. Louis. More than 80 people were arrested during a demonstration that included Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. And protest is a form of exercising your civic rights. And like any form of exercise, most of us don't do it. And those who do understand it carries some risks. Today, we're going to talk about some of these risks that the protesters face, primarily the medical ones, of course. And if we can maybe help people find ways to mitigate those risks and to help me discuss these young sign-wielding enthusiasts, I have three very special guests, and I'll start with the one with the most House of Pod appearances, ER doctor and toxicologist, Dr. Ryan Marino. Ryan, welcome back.
Hello, welcome to myself, I guess. I don't know why I was saying welcome.
Allow myself to introduce myself. Dr. Ryan, it's so good to see you, buddy.
I think you have the most House of Pod appearances, actually.
There's only one episode I have not been on. That's an actual fact.
Coming for you.
Yes, it was a strange experience to hear my show without me on it, but I am back, baby. So joining us also is a return guest and friend, James Stout, investigative journalist, historian, podcaster, has a PhD in modern European history, and his work spans topics like anti-fascism and the Spanish Civil War. You may have seen his writing in the National Geographic magazine. It's a fantastic magazine. Esquire, Smithsonian, and more. James, welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me. That was you've made me all embarrassed now. You've oversold me, I think. I'm here to represent the real doctors. I do want to make that clear.
The PhD versus the PhD MD. Ooh. Yeah, we. I don't know if you know this, but we care about who is called a doctor and who isn't.
Yeah, I've seen the op-eds actually. Yeah.
Joining us for the first time is Dr. Rupa Maurya, physician and associate professor of medicine at UCSF. She's committed to decolonizing medicine and addressing health disparities. She is an author whose book, Inflamed: Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice, examines the root causes of health disparities. And she's the co-founder of the Do No Harm Coalition, which I believe we're going to discuss. First of all, may I call you Rupa?
You can.
Rupa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. And I welcome myself as well.
I'm glad you're here.
I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to meet you all in person.
You know, Rupa, this is our first time meeting face-to-face, so to speak, over a Zoom screen. But I did know about you from a long time ago, not from any of the things I mentioned, not from medicine, nothing else. Do you know how I knew about you from way back when, where I heard your name first many years, like 20 years ago?
Just rocking with my band.
That's exactly right. Because we both grew up playing music in bands in San Francisco. And I remember I was at like a gig and I was playing with another band and they're like, oh, you're a doctor? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, it was in training. I was in medical school. I forget something, some part of my training. And they're like, yeah, we played with this other person. She's in a band and she's a doctor too. And I was like, fuck that. I'm the only doctor musician.
You're the only doc star.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. I was always kind of hoping we would like run into each other at a gig or a show, but we never did. But you were in a band called Rupa and the April Fishes.
That's correct.
Very good. Very good. We have to make that happen one day. We have to make a show happen here, like a decolonized medicine show. But speaking of which, can you first question I have for you is, can you explain what it means to decolonize medicine?
That's a big topic.
Yeah. Can you sum it up in 20 seconds?
I can sum up my book in 10 seconds.
Yeah. Thank you.
Just make medicine work for all people, basically. That the structures of power that medicine, as we learned it, the Western medical model, was a part of the colonial trifecta of M's, militaries, medics, and missionaries, were part of like the ways in which our lands, my homeland of Punjab and your homeland and other people's homelands, were colonized by Europe about 600 years onward ago. And so the medical training that we've learned, the science that we've learned, how it was, how the knowledge was gained through this logic of supremacism and domination. It was not gained through a kind of logic that enlists the support of living systems to understand how to be healthy or how to be well. And we can contrast that to, let's say, my friend Namonte Nenkemo is one of the uncontacted. Well, she's very contacted now. She's all over the world. She's on Time magazine. She's a forest defender of the Amazon, a Warani woman who, you know, their people just treat medicine in a very different way. And so decolonizing medicine really is looking at the dynamics of power that have structured medicine, who gets offered dialysis, who doesn't, how healthcare resource dollars are spent, how they're not. How we define addiction, for example, and how we penalize or don't penalize people because of it, how we pathologize certain things and not others. So there's all these dynamics going down to the very pulse oximeter that will measure your oxygen level in the hospital and decide whether or not you get hospitalized for oxygen during the COVID pandemic or sent home. And often to catastrophic consequences. All of these things, from the technologies to how we build AI, which is a big problem I'm seeing, you know, right now, to how we understand the science, has been dictated by dynamics of history and power. And so to decolonize medicine is to really unpack that and to reshape how medicine can work for everybody. It does not mean we throw science out of the window. It does not mean we throw peer review out of the window. It's that we start incorporating more peers into what that looks like and what that is. And I've been very blessed and excited to be invited into partnership with different indigenous communities around the country, especially, but now around the world, to imagine what this looks like in practice. And it's exciting. It's very exciting because it is much more, it addresses the kinds of problems that people have with chronic inflammatory disease that we see, you know, off the charts of what I see. Most of the burden of disease that I see is chronic inflammatory disease. And it's exciting. So this is an important moment to start, you know, to continue that conversation and to really think about it. Because we're seeing how U.S. medical institutions are totally silent in the face of the wholesale destruction of an entire healthcare system, targeted and attacked against international humanitarian law, as Israel has bombed all the hospitals, executed doctors and patients alike within the healthcare context. So this thing that we all hold sacred, our work as healthcare workers in the hospital, that has been deemed to be, you know, a safe zone, has been completely desecrated. And not one institution has spoken out about it. In fact, our own UCSF Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, who was our vice whatever of health equity, is now the editor of JAMA that published a piece back in November, creating moral ambiguity, like maybe there is a good time to bomb hospitals. This guy, Wainia, who's apparently an ethicist, put that forward. So this is an important time to look at, like, okay, why are we making those statements right now? Why is no one, no institution, and no person in health equity in their formal role in the institutions of medicine saying anything as we're witnessing what's happening to our colleagues and this and the profession? Why is no one saying anything? So that gets to the heart of questions of history and power. And that, to me, gets at the heart of why Black, Brown, and Indigenous people have poor health outcomes in the United States, because those are architectures of power. So sometimes people talk about, like, decolonize your lifestyle, decolonize your diet, decolonize your blah, blah, blah. And it's not about, you know, something you can do as an individual. It's something we have to take on collectively, which is why these student protests are so exciting, because we're seeing this rising of a collective intelligence and process, which really centers, you know, community care and knowledge and bringing forth these learnings that have happened in the last, you know, many, many years in the colonial, anti-colonial resistance across colleges and universities in the United States.
Well, that's really nice. And that brings us into, I think, nicely into the topic of the day, which is these protesters and what they're facing and what they're experiencing. I know you've had experience, you know, both at Standing Rock and during George Floyd protests. But let me start with a very basic question for some of our listeners who just may not be paying that close of attention for whatever reason. And maybe I'll start with you, James, and I want, you know, Rupa, and I want Ryan to weigh in on this as well. But let's start with a basic question that may not be so easy to answer, which is, why are these students protesting? What are they protesting for?
Yeah, so I think what they're protesting for is liberation for the people of Palestine. There are probably a multiplicity of views, and I don't pretend to speak for everyone or indeed anyone. On behalf of any organization. But I think it's very clear what they're protesting against, right? And as someone who writes about anti-fascism a lot at work, sometimes that can be a cohering factor, which brings people who may not agree on everything together to disagree with something. And in this case, what they're disagreeing with is the genocide of people in Gaza, right? As we've seen since October the 7th, Israel has been bombing, shelling, rocketing and shooting people in Gaza and drone killing in incredible numbers, right? Killing tens of thousands of children. I've stopped kind of keeping track of the statistics because, like, if 10,000 children doesn't bother you, or 15,000 children going to bother you? Like, how many piles of dead babies do you need to care? And they're taking a look at that and essentially like saying, we don't want this. And specifically, what they're protesting at universities, right, is the complicity of their universities. So the demands are somewhat different in every university. Lots of them center around BDS, right? Boycott, divestment, sanctions. So for instance, if I look at the university that I spent most time at, I did my PhD at UC San Diego, right? UC San Diego does a whole lot of work on drone programs. It's the same drone programs that allow. Now, in theory, a lot of that work allows more precise targeting. If that is the case, either Israel isn't using it very well or they don't care, right? Because they're bombing anyone and everyone. The university has massive grants sometimes to do research from these organizations, right? They sometimes have investments, especially these universities like land grant universities, universities which have significant investments in some of these either military contractors, weapons manufacturers, or military surveillance technology, right? If we look at a lot of the surveillance technology that I see every day in my work at the southern border, whether I'm there doing mutual aid or they're doing reported, I'm always being surveilled by surveillance towers that are made in Israel. Every time I step across, what we've decided is the border, or some of us have decided is the border, I'm being watched by this technology. So the complicity of universities in developing the technology which is killing people in Gaza, right? They're in some cases asking for an academic boycott of Israeli institutions, but I think the grand unifying principle is that by any means necessary, using whatever tools we can, we have to stop the killing of people in Gaza, if I can sort of surmise what I believe they're protesting for.
Ryan, you live in real America. We live in fake America. I don't, coastal, we're coastal elitist here.
The People's Republic of Leftifornia.
That's right.
So
You
progressive here.
and I know you're probably in your own bubble over there in Ohio, but how do you feel these protests are being perceived by people? How, do you feel like people are seeing this as just angry virgins or whatever they're saying the now? Like, are they just angry for no reason, and they just, like Nate Silver says, they don't really know what they're arguing, but it's hip and it's cool to do it, so they're arguing it. How are people viewing it?
Well, so the universities around here have had protests. I mean, there have been big protests outside of even university settings. I mean, people are kind of divided, and it's more on where they fall in terms of how they get their news rather than like what their actual opinions are, because people seem to have opinions that are given to them. And so what I mean, for these college students who are protesting, graduate students, and for the others who are not even affiliated with universities, they seem to be probably the better informed people. And I mean, you alluded to kind of the dialogue is that these students like don't have aren't having sex or whatever. This is how they're getting their rocks off. I mean, those are kind of silly arguments at the end of the day. And I think for students to say that their universities should focus on kind of university things rather than being capitalist products that have investments in like the in warfare and those kind of things, I think that's a pretty reasonable thing that most people get on board with. When I think of a university, I don't think they should be profiting off of warfare. Weapons, all of that kind of stuff.
And let me just clarify for our listeners who don't know what I'm talking about. A New York University, NYU, a professor, Scott Galloway, was like on Fox News or some right-wing cable show, and he was claiming that the reason students are upset with Israel is because college students, sex amongst younger people has gone down, and they're like finding different ways to vent their energy, and they're doing it to protest, which is just a really silly way of arguing that you don't understand why people would be upset about something that's really, really bad. Anyways,
Well, it wasn't just him. Jesse Waters, who has one of the most watched shows in the country, also said that the only reason he said it was mostly females at colleges are protesting because they don't have boyfriends and so they want to hug Palestinians.
awful.
Oh man.
Which
Well, this
tells
goes.
you everything you need to know about Jesse Waters, yeah.
It's him in a nutshell.
Well, this goes. I feel like this really goes to the heart of the issue of narrative control, like the amount of times I've been told I'm naive because I assert that doctors should not be murdered in the hospital. Like that we're in a place right now where the most controversial thing I've said in my career that has been like received the most backlash, and I've been there, you know, on the front line at Standing Rock in front of the in front of the, you know, pipeline. I've been, you know, walking with Black Lives Matter before it was a movement. And the most controversial thing I've said is stop bombing hospitals. That's
Yeah.
where we are.
You
And it
dirty
has
hippie.
to do, and it has to do with this narrative that if you believe that if you can tell a narrative as you know, Netanyahu just said something about savage terrorists that, you know, if I go in front of the ICC, this would be a terrible thing because how will we protect the world from these savage terrorists? It's like, well, who is the savage terrorist? Who is savage here? What does savagery mean? Those words. And I cannot overstate the importance of the work of artists and storytellers and writers right now, because the limits of our imaginings are really circumscribed by our words, our language. And that language is visual, that language is verbal, that language is written, and that language is performative. And what we're seeing in these camps is a different language emerging in our faces, not just online. And that's a very important thing because in their language of the Seder, where the Jewish and Muslim and other students are together and learning from each other, where there's mutual respect, where there's a community of care at all of these encampments as a gosh, what is just prefigurative? It's just imagining the world into being. That's happening through our words. That's happening through our understanding. That's happening through our dialogue, our discourse, and our language. And so when you get these people who have invested, if you look at these troll armies online and people who are out there trying to advance this narrative that, oh, they're just not getting laid and they're just not this and they're just not that and they're so naive. We're living in a time where the skills that are being learned at these camps around the country right now and around the world, and the same thing happened at Standing Rock. There was a young college student who's graduating who asked for a half an hour of my time today for just mentorship. Can you talk to me about, you know, what should I be doing? I was like, the most important learning you can get right now is in these camps. Because everything we're going to have to do for the climate, you're going to learn in these camps. Everything we're going to have to do to bring forward a better world is you're going to learn in these camps. And so, because this is an active space of new language emerging, new language between us emerging, and that is so important and so powerful and
Yeah.
cannot be overstated.
Yeah. And speaking of these camps, let's start to talk about some of the risks they're facing. First, let's just talk about the legal risk that they're facing. James, what charges are they facing? I don't understand what, I mean, I'm sure it's different and there's lots of different examples, but what charges are most of these people who are being arrested facing?
Yeah, so from what I've seen, there are two chief categories, or like the emphasis, it's more like one charge, and then the usual bolt-on charges you get when the police attack you and you react like any person would, you know, being attacked by a cop or anyone else, right? So the main charge people are getting is trespass, because the universities have said like we're closing down this building slash quad, or you know the you know you're not welcome here. Oh, you can't come here, or you have to leave at night, whatever it is, right? And then they're being charged with trespass for that. They're also then being charged with resisting arrest, right? Or some form of, you know, variations upon that assault of it, if the cops think they can get away with that, right? Or with, you know, anything that they do in that time when they are being assaulted by the cops can be used to charge them, right? Those are the charges we've seen so far. They haven't really had time to build up much in the way of cases, right? Like it's not unreasonable to think that they will charge other charges. Graffiti is another one that people have been charged with, right? Vandalism. So they're all, when I say relatively minor charges, I want everyone to understand that like even any interaction with the legal system can be deadly, and that any criminal charges can have significant negative impacts on your life, and it shouldn't be the case, but that is the case right now in this country. So that is currently the legal exposure, in addition to being suspended from or expelled from, in some cases, your university, which kind of, as someone who's taught at universities since 2008, kind of blows my mind. Like, I've had to deal with Identity Europa on campus. I have seen some of the most, we had older people like myself who remember in 2010 at UCSD when we had the Black Winter, right? When we had someone hanging nooses on campus. We had the horrific, just some of the most obvious racist shit you're ever going to encounter. And none of those people encountered really any form of university discipline and sanctions. So to see people who are exercising what is like smack in the middle of their First Amendment rights persecuted in this way is deeply disturbing, like as an academic and as a person. Those are kind of the chief exposures. I saw someone saying someone had been charged with hate crimes against a cop. So I'm not sure if that's true.
I'm sorry.
If there's anyone who should not be protected by hate crime legislation, it's the cops. But here we are, I guess. So those are the charges. That no, you know, that doesn't mean there won't be more. That doesn't mean they won't try and slap conspiracy charges on people, right? Like, especially this, some of these more aggressive DAs who have sort of made their name as being the people who go after protesters and kind of really pandering to that suburban unease about young people having opinions. These DAs will try and go as hard as they can after these people, right? And because they do represent a genuine threat to a system which benefits hugely from the industry that is killing children in Palestine right now. And they do have a capacity to change things. That's why the law and order system, that's why the state is using its full violence, its full force of violence against these young people, because they do have like a lever to pull on. Right, and they can really wedge this in a way that big protests haven't. Right, we saw massive protests. I was in Syria and Iraq, or I was in Kurdistan, which happens to be within Syria and Iraq, for the first few weeks after October 7th. So I wasn't here. I wasn't present. Some of the bigger protests, but we have seen large protests. They didn't do shit. Right, like nothing seems to have stopped Joe Biden sending a fire hose of weapons and money to the IDF. But this angle is potentially a very effective one. And I think that's why we're seeing the full coercive force of state. I don't know if you saw what's happening in Irvine today, but like, the cops are stopping people getting water, which they're not beating the like cops are the same as the IDF allegations, right? You're kind of, you're not helping yourself. Cops already do, but they will do anything they can to stop this. That is probably a sign that it's working.
And the mayor of Irvine actually just recently put out something I thought was sort of surprising.
Remarkable.
Right?
Like, I'm very familiar with Southern California Democrat mayors being pieces of shit. I would like to include our own mayor, Paul Gloria, in that statement. But the mayor saying, like, asking the cops to stand down and preemptively condemning anything they do to intervene to deprive these students of their First Amendment rights, I thought was really refreshing.
I was surprised, I have to say.
To the audience.
James, I have a question for you. Can you break down a little bit the distinction? So I was a graduate at UCSD as well, and I'm a professor at UCSF. Mm-hmm. Are there different protections for free speech? So is an encampment, let's say, in a public thoroughfare at a public university, have different protections for free speech, our First Amendment rights, compared to these private universities like Columbia? Which I've heard that, it'd be nice if they got First Amendment rights, but they're actually not guaranteed in private entities in the United States, just like at corporations.
I can see that being the case, actually. I'm not by no means an expert on this stuff. I'm very lucky to have First Amendment lawyers who I can speak to when I need them for work. It is my understanding that, yes, certainly in public, I've never been to a private university, I'm afraid. I don't have the financial means to attend private universities, and I don't want to teach them for that reason. From what I understand, certainly at a public university, you do have a very broad First Amendment right. And it's worth noting that, like, very recently, actually, I think the case was Colwood versus Colorado, the Supreme Court clarified that where First Amendment statements, and this is a Supreme Court which is full of terrible people who have made dogshit decisions, right? I think we can all agree on that. Where statements verge on violence, it is more important to protect the freedom of speech than it is to prosecute the violence. And if prosecution of violence leans towards repression of speech, then it shouldn't be done, right? So like it's a ruling that like coming from them, obviously it comes in the context of like, you know, 4 years of people making threats at like public health officials because they had to wear a mask once, right? And we probably shouldn't overlook that, but what they've clarified there, I think, is important, that like you have a very broad First Amendment right. And I've never seen anyone making threats at any of these encampments, right? I have memories of seeing thoroughfares being blocked at, you know, various protests, including the ones at UC San Diego that happened in the Black Winter, as we'll call it, right? People can look that up if they're not familiar. It didn't get a lot of press coverage, but there is a Wikipedia page. If you're blocking things like roads, yeah, you are going to encounter different consequences. And I think there's different consequences even on freeways compared to like road surface roads. Private universities do have a much broader sort of remit to restrict access and also to like to kick people out, right? And I guess, yeah, if it's the same, certainly for faculty, right, your rights might be very limited there. That's not to say that like I know people at UCSD who have been maybe you'll remember like the transport and migrant tool, and you're like people attempted to detenure professors for that, right? Or they, if you remember the cancer issue in the literature building, again, I feel like professors there faced long-term career consequences for their speech. But yeah, I think you are taking a bigger risk at a private university. Certainly as a student, you are taking a bigger risk of having your academic career impacted.
Well, speaking of impacted, we have some ads we have to get our finger deep into and pull out. Ryan knows that, the disimpaction joke. Anyway, sorry. I'm terrible at this. Stay tuned. We're going to come back and we're going to talk more about the physical risks these students are under.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And welcome back. Ooh, those were good ads, or ad, depending on how many they played. Ryan, you know, you're an ER doctor, correct?
Correct.
You've seen some shit, haven't you, man?
Too much.
Too much. Too much. You know, the thing that I don't think has happened yet, but it feels inevitable at this point, and I hope I'm wrong, is the use of tear gas. This is sort of the most common topic that comes up when we talk or raise the subject of, you know, health risks. There's a lot of other ones, so I think we'll address them. But I think this is the first one we should probably talk about is tear gas. Can you tell us a little bit about it, how it harms people and what people can do if they're exposed to it at these protests?
Yeah. And I think so far, actually, tear gas has been documented at UT Austin and maybe Emory, but is possibly being used in more situations than that. And tear gas is worth talking about because the use of tear gas, I mean, it is very controversial with good reason. And tear gas, kind of quote unquote, as a phrase, refers to a lot of different compounds. None of them are actually gases. And the main one that's used nowadays is essentially the same as pepper spray. It's capsaicin, the irritating spicy compound from hot peppers, or that's what's the only one that's supposed to be used, at least in this country. But tear gas, like as a concept, which interestingly they're banned in warfare, although they're allowed to be used on college kids, and on your own citizens at home. These agents are considered like non-lethal force, non-killing mechanisms. They're supposed to not be like bullets, that kind of thing. Although if anyone looks into it, there's many deaths documented from the use of tear gas agents, even recently in very recent years in the United States, in other Western kind of modern countries that are supposed to be more progressive. And so that on the surface is disturbing.
You mentioned that you can use it on your own citizens, but not during times of war. And actually, we did an episode back during the George Floyd protests. We talked about this a little bit, and I learned a little bit about the history of it. And it was developed first after World War One. It was really to break enemy lines, like cause disorientation, make people kind of like scared and cause pain. And then in 1997, they were like, they had this chemical weapons convention. They're like, well, we don't want people thinking that we're using nerve gas. And then they use nerve gas on us. So then they made it illegal to use in war. So it cracks me up that we can use it on our own citizens, but we can't use it in war. I don't know. I find it like deeply cynical. The whole thing is so funny to me. But tell us a little bit about what happens in a situation. Actually, first, let me ask you this before I go into this. I'm just curious. Who here, and you can either say it or raise your hand, but listeners won't be able to see if you don't want them to know. Who here has experienced tear gas, has been tear gassed? I see one hand up. I see two hands up.
I've been in the decontamination, so I was exposed to it, but I haven't been gassed myself.
I've had secondhand as well.
I've had pepper spray, but I haven't had tear gas, like police tear gas. I have a story about that I'll share. It's probably not appropriate for the air. Anyways, James, what was it like? Can you describe your situation?
Man. It's you know, you're going to start, like, depending on how they're deploying it, right? Like, they have foggers now. They have, like, tear gas. They can launch out of, like, a 40-millimeter grenade-type device. They can deploy it from...
Like one of those things, the t-shirt cannons that they have at basketball games.
Yeah, but that's it's not.
But not as much fun.
Not as fun.
It's not as fun as getting a free t-shirt, believe me. Especially if they're firing them like direct impact, which could be. This is how people lose eyes and other parts of their body. But yeah, it's very unpleasant, right? Like as it comes towards you, you'll start to feel it tingling, and then suddenly just. Yeah, the irritation on all of your skin, right? Any exposed skin, not just your eyes, but obviously mostly these like mucous membranes, eyes, mouth, nose. It's very unpleasant. It's why I bring a gas mask to protest. It's completely debilitating, and it's very hard to conduct yourself in any sort of coherent manner, right? Because your whole body is like, it gets less bad with time. You know, the more times it's happened to you, you know that you'll be okay, but at first I think your body's like, oh fuck, I'm dying, sensors are going off,
right.
When you get tear gassed, and it's deeply unpleasant, and it's obviously deeply indiscriminate. Like, it's not a targeted thing, right? You're just going to release tear gas in a city block, and house people living there are also going to get tear gassed. Folks living on that street are also going to get tear gas. Animals in the vicinity are also going to get tear gas. And it's very cruel. And
the cruelty is literally the point. So, I mean, some of the other terms for these agents are lacrimators, which is they induce tearing. But they, almost all of them, work on pain receptors in the body. And so even though, like, capsaicin, it's what's in hot sauce, hot peppers, that kind of thing, when you spray someone with tons of capsaicin, I mean, that causes all over body pain. You have these pain receptors in every part of your body. So not only, I mean, are your eyes watering, you lose vision, that kind of thing, but like, this physically hurts until you get all of this off of those receptors. And some of the historical agents that were used, which I should mention also that it's very difficult to know what's actually being used. I mean, people could be using agents that are not supposed to be used, that have significant health risks, that are not like the things that are in hot pepper plants, which again are not totally benign themselves. But we kind of have to like take people's word for it, and these other agents still exist. And the reason they're not supposed to be used is not just because they have all of these risks, but like certain former tear gas agents, and when I say former, I mean going back maybe like 10 years, these have been documented as being used in Western nations, including the United States, but can have like breakdown products that are very toxic, deadly, or carcinogenic, and so these are most likely still in use in a lot of places. But yeah, the reason that these are used is that the suffering is the point. They want people to hurt without killing you, without having like organ damage or marks that someone will need to be in the hospital for, but you still suffer nonetheless.
Yeah.
And so it is kind of like a hand washing mechanism for making people suffer without having to take any responsibility for it.
Some of the and James, what you were saying, that you can experience it and you'll know you'll be okay and then move on. And that's true for some people, but for others, and I'm thinking of an activist here in the Bay Area, Kabir, who went into status asthmaticus after George Floyd, through several rounds of being gassed. So depending on the substrate, so what your underlying condition is like, the additive effect of these gases can actually be deadly. And another problem that we're seeing is with the hiring of these military mercenaries, like we had at Standing Rock. So we were all subjected to this Tiger Swan. So these military contractors who are cutting their teeth in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in Palestine are bringing in other kinds of weapons. So to your point, Ryan, we don't actually know what they were gassing us with, but we know that several elders from Standing Rock have now died of cancer. Like a disproportionate number have died of different kinds of cancers. And now we're starting to see liver failure in people who, in their 40s who were repeatedly exposed. So this is actually a huge problem when we're looking at the efforts to stop Cop City and these different movements across the United States that recognize that what is being positioned to us as benign crowd control is actually coming from very deadly attempts to suppress, oppress, repress people organizing together to do what is our constitutional right in the United States, which is to govern ourselves in a way that is befitting of our people, like what serves the people. And so when we talk about these, they will talk about, I'm sure, the news as people start to get hurt by these things. We'll see more news stories about this. They're framed as less lethal or non-lethal forms of crowd control. And again, when I was at Standing Rock, it was myself and a trauma surgeon, a Cherokee trauma surgeon, were the only two physicians on camp at that time that they were using rubber bullets in the faces and the groins specifically of bare-chested indigenous youth praying in the water. And one of the young people ended up coughing up a full cup of blood into his hand. From a contusion. He had a big, a
Chest
big
contusion.
welt on his chest. And there are documented case reports of exsanguination from pulmonary artery rupture from these rubber bullets. So what's being posed to us as non-lethal forms of crowd control are actually deadly and should not be used on chill like young people. I still see college students as to me, I'm a mom, children or young kids, young adults who are stepping into their voices and they're trying to start building their ideas of what the world should be. And we really saw that at Standing Rock. And for myself, it's been exciting and terrifying to see that what happened down there. I remember when myself and the surgeon were standing together, this kid coughed up the blood. I was like, holy shit, I want to call 911. But now I realize 911 are the people who are shooting the kids with these, like, there's actually no 911. And that's the reality when you get to street medic work, when you get to the legacy of street medic work, there is, you know, how do we address the complicity of the US medical system with the state? How do we know that our people are safe when they go from a protest situation into the medical situation? How do we stabilize people in extremely chaotic situations that our students are already facing and professors being slammed on the ground? How do we prepare people who have been either clinically trained to be in these situations and be effective, to be able to take care of the community so that they can express what they need to express, i.e. stop the genocide in Gaza, stop supporting Israeli apartheid, the apartheid state, stop arming Israel. How do we support them in ways that can ensure their health as much as possible so that we can start to mobilize? You know, the revolutionary force will never come from the professional classes. Too many of the doctors and lawyers have been bought off by this structure. But when we have these moments like this, there are openings where people can step in and start to understand that we can start moving resources of knowledge, moving resources of care, to help support these kinds of movements. And so that's the role that we can and should be playing right now to protect the young people.
I want to hear a little bit more about that. But before we move off the topic, for our listeners who still may want to know a little bit about what to do if they're exposed to tear gas, I'll just say some things real quick. And Ryan, you tell me if you agree. So for most people, it will go away after 10 to 30 minutes, but it's especially dangerous for people with respiratory conditions, and it can, with prolonged exposure, affect people who don't in terms of respiratory distress, and sometimes very significant. It's associated with spontaneous abortions as well. One of the key things is get to a higher ground if you can, where it settles, because as Ryan mentioned, it's a powder that's been aerosolized, and that can get into the cornea, and you need a lot of water. I've read about 1 to 2 liters of water, which is more than most of us will have in an emergency situation like that, to really wash out the eyes. One important thing that keeps coming up is milk. People keep talking about using milk for these situations. Ryan, or James for that matter, any use of milk in these situations? Let's address this now once and for all.
If you're hungry for milk, then that would be the only indication for milk.
That would be a badass protester who's like drinking milk and dipping his cookie into the milk while there's tear gas going off around them.
Yeah, no, but milk is unnecessary. The main thing is the best thing is to avoid exposure. So if you know you're in a situation that's at risk and can have something like a gas mask, I mean, that is going to be the best thing. But getting away from it, and then decontamination, and for almost all of these agents, the main thing, I mean, is going to be water decontamination. So getting under a shower, getting into an eye wash, if it's in your eyes, the eyes are probably the worst part, but getting all of your clothes off that have the substance on it, because those will continue exposing you to it, because this isn't a gas. It's either a powder, a solid, or a liquid that's been dispersed, been aerosolized. They're trying to mimic gases, but none of the agents are actually gases.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. If we're going to talk about gas masks, can I just say my little gas mask piece really quickly? Because this is something that...
Please do. And I have a follow-up question for you once you do
magic.
That.
People are going to want to buy gas masks. And if 2020 is any indication, lots of people will. If these protests spread and grow and many more people become involved. And you're going to be tempted to go online, and you're going to be tempted to buy an old surplus gas mask. And I'm going to suggest that you don't, because many of those old surplus gas masks have lenses which are either aged or were not impact resistant to begin with, because they weren't designed for use in this kind of situation. A shattering gas mask lens is a really, it turns a bad day into a really fucking bad day. Swearing a lot on the podcast, sorry, but you're going to have lots of glass in your face. It can be really bad. So if budget is a concern, I would suggest using a half mask. Like a half mask respirator, half face respirator, and then some impact resistant goggles, which you can seal off or can come seal off, as opposed to getting an old check, or, you know, these Eastern Bloc gas masks are pretty cheap, but there's a reason they're cheap. And I would want you guys to avoid having a shattering visor.
And I will tell you, James is not the, I don't think I've heard James say, don't go to the surplus store before. Like, I don't, that's not like, I didn't imagine those words would come out of James's mouth. So that really means something. But
two of the things that James and Rupa both brought up in their most recent points that I think is important is, even though these are considered like non-lethal force, benign, whatever, safe to use on your own people, I mean, there's a lot of outcomes other than death that matter. And so, I mean, if you have things going into your eyes, taking out your eyes, a lot of people have lost eyes, lost their vision.
Yeah.
And that's not even the only problem. Like, these are very problematic. And one other thing I'm glad Rupa had brought up too was talking about Cop City and remembering that when it comes to these kind of riot responses and like riot trained police, a lot of the police in the United States are actually trained by the IDF and for these specific scenarios. So that is also something that's interesting that I haven't seen brought up really in the news. Is that in terms of this kind of riot response, most American police training comes from Israel.
Which is why they're cutting off the water, at UC Irvine. Siege on the encampments.
You guys both mentioned this too, the rubber bullets, you know, causing blindness, especially back during the George Floyd protests. I think there was at least 10 people who lost an eye. I'm sure that number is probably higher. That's all I remember, including some journalists, because these guns, to my understanding, they're not meant to be shot directly at people as they're doing. They're meant to be shot into the ground and then bounce back up or something. Not that that makes it too much better. But speaking of that, the question I had for you, James, is what is a dick flap?
Okay, good question. Excellent question. Yeah, so with the round, it depends what rounds they're using, right? Some of them are impact rounds, some of them are like sponge markers. I've actually got a dick flap here for you, Calvin.
So for our listeners,
does he have an ovary flap? That's what
it's a general multi-purpose groin flap.
A vulva flap. Okay,
vulva
all right.
Flap. Yeah. So all right. For our listeners,
for whatever you've got,
James is holding up. He has an impressive stack there of like military looking vests and protective gear, and there's one that's really cool, has press written right across the chest, and there's a big like,
it's a cod piece, it dangles
a
dangling cod piece.
It's not attached like a cup. This is if people aren't familiar, this is what's called a plate carrier. It carries two hard plates, which depending on the type of plates will stop various types of bullets. It's what I use for work. I have accessorized it with a groin flap, which is just a Kevlar flap, which hangs down from the front of it and hangs in front of your groin.
That's a cod flap.
Yeah.
Cod flap.
It has morale enhancing qualities, I guess. Your plate carrier generally only covers the idea being to cover your heart and lungs, right? So you're avoiding some of the more fatal areas to get shot.
We have to remember that we are paying for this abuse. So instead of paying for healthcare, instead of paying for knowing that everyone can go and see the doctor when they need to and get what they need, we are paying for the increasing militarization of our local police forces, who, as you mentioned, are being trained by the IDF specifically on crowd control. They have been prepared for this moment. They have been waiting for this moment. And so it is a critical time to rapidly expand the knowledge base. There's a great website called Activist Handbook. They have a whole section on riot medicine. Just Google Activist Handbook, riot medicine. And in that, they've compiled a bunch of different handbooks on street medicine, and also how we as healthcare providers can apply our clinical knowledge into settings, how we can be prepared. If there is anybody who is, you can look at the frontline medics. Many of these medics were working at Standing Rock and other frontline spaces. take a training, take a bridge training of clinicians out there if you want to participate in keeping students safe right now and offering your medical care to support their voices coming forward to support the end of the genocide in Gaza. Take a bridge training so that people can learn some of these skills and tactics that are applicable to, you know, bringing your clinical knowledge into a very chaotic situation, making it work, learning the dynamics of being a physician or a nurse who's been working in Western medicine and going into learning a street side manner that is very different than bedside manner, that has all sorts of different dynamics around consent and learning how to be in service of oppressed communities who are fighting for their rights to have a dignified life. This is an important time to expand our own knowledge base. And there's people out there who are willing to do these trainings. We'll be hosting one through the Do No Harm Coalition and our partners in Berkeley next weekend on May 4th. But there'll be, it sounds like a lot more starting to crop up so that we can get the med students and the residents and the young doctors who are hungry to show up and support these students in their
Tell us a little bit more about the Do No Harm Coalition. Tell us what you're, how you're training people, like what kind of courses that they're getting, what kind of education they have to go through for this, or get to go through for this.
So the Do No Harm Coalition formed as a group of healthcare workers who organized in the face of a hunger strike in San Francisco back in 2016. There were several community members who sat and went on a hunger strike in San Francisco. And when I went to go meet with them on like day four of their strike, I knew several of them from the music scene. So Equipto and Selassie were part of the San Francisco music scene. They knew me through the music scene, and that's where that trust started. And I accompanied them on their hunger strike. And that was a very important opening for me to see, you know, the way that music and activism and healthcare went together. Because I've been touring around the world for several years with my band. And I was specifically looking at the way health and society were, how social structures and dynamics were impacting health in all the different places that we went to. And then here was this experience here in the Bay, which really transformed my understanding of how to bring my work in healthcare into a more relevant framework with my, in alignment with my music and the things that I was concerned about. So some medical students stopped, like reached out, they're like, we want to help. And then residents came, and then physical therapy students and nursing students and nurses, and all these people came out. They're like, we want to help. And so it grew from like five of us to thousands of us during George Floyd. And so we, you know, went out to Standing Rock, called by California Native people to help as the police were becoming increasingly violent. But our work is really to understand the health impacts of state violence, and that to create health for all, we have to actually take on those structures. And we're not going to have a healthy society until we dismantle structures of oppression. And that includes state violence and police. And so this is the work that we do. And we've been, you know, we put a bridge training up. It's on YouTube. I think I put like it, during George Floyd, I was like, called my friend Noah. We were on the, in Standing Rock together, setting up the medic's tent that the Indigenous grandmothers asked us to come out there and do that. And I said, Noah, help me do this bridge training. 48 hours later, we had like 8,000 people signed up. And you know, there's still people are, we put it up on YouTube so people can visit it, Do No Harm Coalition Bridge Street Medic Training, to learn about the kinds of things that you might not know about as a clinician when entering a situation that becomes chaotic when the police show up, and how to do that work safely. Like, you don't want to be exposed to tear gas because you need to be there to take care of everyone else who's been exposed to tear gas. Right. So you want to be there setting up space, holding space to help take care of the people who are willing to confront this power in this particular way.
So you put out a lot of good sites for people to go check out. The Activist Handbook is what you meant, is that what?
Yes.
And that, if people did ask online about this, if people are looking for what to bring in terms of supplies or to donate, that'll show them. What kind of things, could you name a couple of the things that you would be looking for Like, I know there's a ton, but like,
I like to have decompression needles and airway. I like to have a little bit more of an advanced kit because I can do that. And I'm sure Ryan, you being an ED doc, like, so that's what's exciting is when you get people who are trained in a little bit more advanced techniques who can handle getting someone stabilized. Because sometimes in these situations, it takes a while for an ambulance to get in. That police won't let the ambulance in. So you, as the physician, especially the ER trained trauma doc or the nurse, might be the only thing that can keep someone like stable enough to be able to get to the higher level of care. So there are all sorts of tips in that handbook on how to stabilize people. No one wants you doing, thoracotomy tubes, in the street. Although in France they do that. here, like, we just want to get people to a better level of care. And then how do you do that in a way where people aren't going to be persecuted when they get there? So you send an advocate. And who's your advocate? Ideally, it's someone who's very versed in that medical world and can navigate. And that was something that came up at Standing Rock. We had these young Native people with critical issues refusing to go to the hospital in Bismarck, which was the next high-level trauma center, because they were so racist against Native people. Refused. And so it became this thing where we had to say, okay, I will leave the camp to go with you and be that doctor translator for you. Because when people are taking these stances in times of political repression, these spaces are not wholly friendly. And so you need your advocates there, you need your other people there. And so
People
this
can
is.
communicate with that medical world. Yeah. That's really interesting. I mean, when I reached out to people online just to see, I reached out to people who seem to be active, involved with street medicine. I talked to a couple of EMTs who seemed awesome and doing some really great work, some nurses. I actually did not run in to too many doctors. In fact, I'm sure they're out there and I just miss them. But you're one of the only, and essentially the only one that I have any contact with that I know that's out there doing stuff like that. Why aren't more doctors involved in this directly?
Well, the younger generation, that's what's exciting. I think I was just born at the wrong time, or maybe the music just time warped me into another time. But the younger generation is very active, and they're coming forward and advancing whole new, articulations of this work. But a lot of them have never been brutalized by the cops, or have never been in a situation where they're like, oh my God, this is an actual war zone, and I can't call 911. So when you get to that state, and for me, that was a real trauma moment where I had to spend some time healing, like from that as a provider, from what I saw, that it's not, doctors again are part of the colonial. We are foot soldiers for empire, period. And if you doubt it, look at every health equity, anti-racist, whatever person who has that in their job title who said jack shit about Gaza as their colleagues have been executed. So you understand where power lies and people's allegiance to power, certain kinds of power. And so doctors who are coming in now, so as the Do No Harm Coalition started, that group is now graduated, they're now attendings. And now there's young people coming in through Healthcare Workers for Palestine. They're doing great work. People are learning, but people are not still. They haven't committed class suicide yet. And when they're ready to do that, race class suicide, when they're ready to say, okay, I will put this to the flame so that all may be healthy, so that all may be well, then we're in another epoch. Then we're opening the door to another chapter of humanity. And that's what excites me, is because I'm seeing that energy. Like, I'm willing to sacrifice my privilege. I will never be the department chair of anything. I'm in academic medicine. I will never be invited to blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm too quote controversial. But when I'm in that space, the students will come and they show up, and the residents come and they show up. And you use that privilege in that space to take those resources and mobilize them for the community. And so that's the work that I do, because I was trained by equally my amazing professors in medicine and Karina Gould, our Ohlone elder in, of Sigourite Land Trust, and Tiny, who's from Poor Magazine and organizing around poor people's solutions to homelessness, and LaDonna out at Standing Rock, and Deborah Whiteplume, and these are my teachers, Walter Riley, civil rights leaders. So when we understand that for me, and I call that work deep medicine, and I talk about this in my book, Inflamed, that is the practice of deep medicine, when we start to understand that history and power are sedimented in our bodies. History and power actually sound out the full suite of inflammatory response. That's why people are getting sick in the ways that they are. So when we start to treat the whole system as physicians, we start to see outcomes that benefit the whole system, which means the water, the salmon, the trees, the people. And we're a part of that. So that's, I don't know, I think it's the sexiest thing in the world. but I haven't started, a medical school yet. There's people actively trying to silence me and shut me down and discredit me and call me intellectually bankrupt. But I know, what I see, and that work is in the struggle.
Yeah.
No, I think so many good points there. One thing that I think is interesting too, in talking about kind of the increasing militarization of our police, and kind of going even back to the George Floyd Black Lives Matter protests from 2020, is something that I think a lot of people aren't aware of, is that opioid settlement funds, which totally unrelated to the discussion we're having here, but millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, probably at this point billions of dollars, that United States public municipalities have obtained from pharmaceutical companies in relation to our, like, quote unquote opioid epidemic. A lot of that money has been used to buy riot gear, to buy police vehicles, PPE, that kind of thing. And so I think people should just be aware that the government is getting money on behalf of citizens being harmed and then using it to harm citizens. And so, like, that's a problem for me. And one thing that I think is interesting about kind of this riot response, whatever you want to call it, the, like, crowd control thing, is no one's using aerosolized fentanyl, because that's not a real thing.
Hey,
anyway,
because they don't want to kill everyone. All it would take is one little tiny bit of aerosolized fentanyl. You could kill the entire Western seaboard, Ryan. You know that. I'm kidding for our listeners who aren't aware of that. That is not true. Anyways, okay. This is fantastic, but I have more questions, but we'll have to do this some other time, because I have to shut this sucker down. First of all, I want to thank all of you. I really appreciate this conversation and appreciate your time. Rupa, what can we plug for you? What would you like to plug before we step out?
I would like to plug a free Palestine. I would like to have all eyes on the Gaza Health Ministry, on Healthcare Workers for Palestine, on the activation of healthcare workers around the world to create a huge wave of solidarity to help stop the insanity, to stop the killing, and to start mobilizing massive resources to rebuild that healthcare infrastructure for the people of Gaza and for the people of Palestine.
And people can find more about you and the Do No Harm Coalition where?
Online. I'm on Instagram. We're on Instagram, Do No Harm Coalition, Rupa Maria, and on Twitter. I refuse to call it by its whatever.
No. Nobody does. Nobody does. Okay. Jamathan, what can we plug for you?
Jamathan.
So things I'd like to plug. I'm just looking for one, which you can edit this shit out here. Hang on. There we go. So I am writing a book for AK Press about anarchists at war. You can read it when I'm done writing it, which will be a while. If you're an anarchist and you want to attend any other wars, it will take even longer. But here we are. You can listen to me far too often on the It Could Happen Here podcast.
Not enough, in my humble opinion. Not enough.
Five days a week, you can hear me and my friends talking about stuff on It Could Happen Here. You can find it where you get podcasts given away for free. And the thing I would like to plug is my friend Ahmed. He is trying to get his family out of the Gaza Strip right now. He is an incredible young man. I've known him for a long time, and I really hope that his family can be okay. He's got a GoFundMe. It's gofund.me/F6B1F7BE. I'll send it to Kari too,
Yeah.
so you can put it in the show notes or whatever. But yeah, if you could help my friend, help his family, you don't have to buy my fucking book. I've written another book about the anti-fascist Olympics. If you want to email me, I'll give it to you. There you go.
I'm going to read all your books, all your stuff. I want it all, and we'll have you back to talk about it, hopefully before it's done. And then after. Ryan, what about you? What's happening with Ryan? What's happening in Ryan's world?
I don't have anything to plug. I think people should spend some time getting aware of what's going on, figure out where your municipal dollars are going, and what you can do to stop war crimes and warfare from happening in the world.
Yeah. Thank you to all the protesters out there. Hey guys, while you're there, also have sex too, safely too, just so they can't use
Yeah.
that against you, okay?
Don't get
You
charges
deserve
for
it.
doing it like too publicly though, because they'll
Oh
be
yeah, don't
there.
do it publicly. Yeah. Fine,
I just
fine.
want to say,
Intent.
Ryan, we need you to write a book.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I would.
yeah.
I have to be able to write though.
No, you can write. You can
Yeah, man,
write.
you could just
It just
compile all the cops who
you
overdosed on
hey,
fentanyl.
you two
It
get together. Get
just
together
hurts.
with Jamathan here, and you can write a book together. It would be
Yeah,
awesome.
you gotta write.
I would like to thank Dr. Jason Rosenbaum for ad copy. Thank you to Nadine for help with production here. Please rate and review our show if you haven't. We are actually now number 14 on the Spotify top science medicine slash whatever podcast, but I'm behind Brett Weinstein and Sam Harris, and I can't fucking deal with
Oh,
that. That
well,
really hurts. That
not
really hurts me,
anymore.
guys.
Not
Come
any.
on.
Not after this one, man.
Yeah.
Not after
Yeah.
this
Come
one.
on. Come on, guys. Help me
Those
beat them.
are real scientists.
Yeah, I'm the mainstream oppression of those scientists. That's what's happening here. Anyways, thank you all so much for coming. I appreciate your time. Bye.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible.
And I'm alive.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today. and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.